Very, very good, and don't let that noise get you down. That was our additional cheer. Welcome to our committee meeting, and we hope that you will find it very interesting. Our first item today is the BC Medicaid Managed Care Waiver follow-up on from our previous discussions, and Dr. Beth Melcher is coming to speak with us on that subject. Dr. Melcher.
Senator, thank you very much for this opportunity to come back. I'm also here with Kelly Crosby from DMA. Last meeting, we presented to you the initial strategic implementation plan, how that plan was developed, the various objectives and goals that we were trying to meet, as well as the action steps to achieve those various objectives. So we won't go back through all of that again. We thought we would update you on developments from the last time we presented, answer some questions that were raised at that meeting, and then be available to you to answer any questions that you might have. The plan has been sent over to all of you. It's also been posted on our websites for the public. So it has been distributed since our last meeting. Probably the biggest thing that has happened since we met last month is that we did close the process for identifying LMEs to proceed to become MCOs. This was a very comprehensive process. It involved the submission of applications by the LMEs in response to an RFA. Those applications were reviewed in a desk review, which is sort of a paper review. But it also included a site review of each of those LME MCO applicants. The folks reviewing both the desk review and the on-site included staff from DMA, from the Division of Mental Health, Developmental Disability and Substance Abuse, also included individuals who were consumers and family members who were trained to review portions of those applications. It also included Mercer Consulting Group as an independent entity to review those applications and to participate in the site reviews. At the completion of that whole process, which was ended on October 31st, we have 11 MCOs that will be proceeding. You have there a map of those, of the configuration and the estimated or projected time on when they will reach the status of being an MCO. At this point, all counties are aligned with some MCO, with the exception of Wake County. And if you read the News and Observer this morning, you know that Wake County is in very serious conversations with Durham to join as an MCO. So we hope and anticipate that that will have a resolution within the next few weeks. We're very pleased with the process. We were very pleased with the energy and the that was put forward by the MCO, by the counties, by the communities to come together under a relatively short time frame. We are very pleased with the applicants that are moving forward. I guess that sort of moves on to the second point. The primary process by which we will be reviewing how these MCOs are proceeding is through what we call the interdepartmental monitoring team. This includes staff both from the MCOs as well as department staff. We also have participation from local provider network groups as well as the local CFAC. We have now initiated an IMT for every one of these MCOs. Some of them have been meeting for a couple of months. Some have just started. But that process is already underway, and we are receiving regular monthly reports from each of them in terms of how they are proceeding and to have a pulse on what issues they're addressing and what problems they may be encountering. Another important component of monitoring how this rolls out is a sort of a overarching advisory group, and we are in the process right now of receiving feedback from all of our major stakeholder groups on how we should constitute that group. We expect that we will convene that group in December. That group will be responsible for hearing reports from each of the IMTs about how implementation is proceeding, to identify issues that cross the MCOs, to review reports. So it really is we see it as an extremely important group to advise us on what's happening and how we need to proceed and what issues we need to be aware of. So, again, we expect we'll be starting that group in December, and we'll be back here to report to you in January on how things are proceeding. In the coming months, if you look through that strategic plan, we have a whole number of committees that we will be convening, and including stakeholder involvement, to look at some initial systems outcome and performance measures that we need to be collecting and tracking. We want to create sort of a standard set of measures that we can submit to you for review over time so that you can see progress. We also will be initiating committees around communication strategies with all of our stakeholder groups, as well as a committee that has already started to meet that's looking at the 1915I as an option for the IDD population. So we have made a good start on this implementation plan, again, are very pleased to have closed the process of identifying the MCOs. I think I'll just stop for one moment and see if there are questions before I go on to the other questions from the last meeting.
Thank you, Dr. Melcher. Members of the committee, are there any questions for Dr. Melcher? Hearing none, please go. I'm sorry. Chairman Dollar has a question.
I'm going to have some questions about the strategic plan. So, unless anybody else has any other questions, I can save those till you finish your presentation.
At the last meeting, we had a few questions that we wanted to come back to you with answers to. One, I believe, Representative Dollar, you asked what exactly was it that these MCOs could contract out. And there you'll see on your handout a list of those things that they are able to contract out. It really is up to the MCO in terms of whether and how they do that. From our perspective, we want to ensure that each of these MCOs has the tools to be able to manage in this environment. Some of these things we know, I think all of the MCOs at this point have contracted out information systems. But I think they're early enough in the process that they're still determining which functions, which business practices make sense for them to be able to contract out versus those that they should keep internal. So there is a whole list, all of them. Some of them were specific to the legislation. Some of them are practices that they could contract out anyway. The other question that was raised was around what the collaboration was between the LMEs and CCNC. We certainly know the importance of making sure that we do everything to work toward increasing enrollment and care coordination and collaboration between CCNC and the LMEs. Quite some time ago, those conversations started about how each of them would be doing care coordination and collaborate with that. There are a set of protocols. There's a model that we call the four-quadrant integration model. Really what it does is look at what are the primary needs of the individual. Are they primarily behavioral health, or are they primarily more medical in nature? And it identifies protocols for who will take primary responsibility for coordinating that care. So that has already occurred. We also have included in the contracts for both CCNC and for the LME MCOs, the requirement that they collaborate, and we will be monitoring that is part of their contract compliance. And that is all I have at this time, but we'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Now, Chairman Dollar has a question.
Thank you. I guess the first one I'll ask you about are what are the plans, or could you elaborate on the plans, outreach strategies for encouraging individuals to sign up with Medicaid? And again, I'm particularly interested in that from both a an individual standpoint, a patient's standpoint. And then I'm also very interested in, because frankly I've been getting some conflicting information about how much information is actually being shared with CCNC so that they can effectively sign people up. And if we don't have the appropriate information being shared, you know, from the LME level to CCNC, if that's not working correctly, then we can't get people signed up on the medical side, and we can't manage those folks in terms of medical home model, and those are among the most expensive people we have in the system. So I'm concerned about the two aspects there. If you could please comment on that.
Kelly Crosby from the Division of Medical Assistance. There are quite a few initiatives and ongoing work groups looking at helping recipients enroll in CCNC. On the behavioral health side, we've actually worked with the department and with local DSS offices and with our behavioral health providers to help individuals sign up for CCNC at the behavioral health provider's office. So that has been an ongoing initiative, and we can get you some information on how that's going, how many people are actually signing up there. Per the Medicaid contract with the LME MCOs, they are required to have monthly meetings with CCNC to exchange and share data on these individuals with care coordination. They're required to incentivize and encourage integrated care practices. They're required to share all their encounter data into the informatics system. The LME MCOs also are required to report to us on their CCNC interactions at each monthly IMT. The LME MCOs are also doing cross-trainings with the local DSS offices. The Medicaid program representatives at the DSS offices have been trained on the managed care initiative, signing people up for the behavioral health benefit, coordinating with the CCNC offices. So there are a lot of things happening at the state level and at the local level that we're monitoring. And we could get some more information on how those initiatives are developing.
Well, I'd like to get those, and I'd like to get some statistics to back up those efforts. And we've got to make sure that we've got that coordination and that the appropriate information is patient information is not being held up going to CCNC so that they can be effective in what they're doing. What we're trying to do overall with Medicaid. The second, I'll move on to another question I've got. In terms of the strategic plan, and I think it's, I may have this right, Action Step 5-5 that talks about resource allocation. And maybe I'm not reading it correctly, but it does seem to me that obviously successful management of the care depends on having reliable, justifiable set of criteria for the distribution of resources in an at-risk system. I think we all agree with that. Shouldn't this resource allocation process be a priority and be established early, as early as possible in the implementation, as opposed to the date that's in there? I think there's a date in there of 7/1/13. Can you talk about that?
I'll start, and then Kelly can add to it. That date in there is the date when all LMEs are to be MCOs. So that date is about making sure that we have statewide implementation of that. There are a few steps that we need to go through to get to that point, and maybe what at some point we need to lay out what all of those are. But we are actually first needing to make sure that we have statewide implementation of the tool, the SIS. We will start that as of January of 2012. We also are working with the developer of that tool. We've been using this at PBH, and what we want to make sure with them is that when you tie the use of that tool to and norm it so that you can create these resource allocation bands, that we're doing that in a way that is responsible and valid. And so actually this, we are in the next week having conversations with that developer about how do we do that and how do we do that appropriately as we add sites. So we will know better. We know that we have to collect more of these instruments on a wider group of people than just that PBH to make sure that whether the data they have gathered is something that either can apply statewide or that we need to expand that norming pool of people so that it's valid across the state. But we are working with a developer. They will be an independent entity that's helping us to develop this, and we will be including stakeholders as we go forward on how we do this in a valid way. So the date that's in there is reflective of all those steps that need to happen before that, but we would absolutely agree with you that as soon as we can implement that resource allocation and as quickly and in as many places as possible, that we will do that.
Okay, thank you very much for that. And let me pick up on another area that I have a question about that you just mentioned, and that is the appropriate stakeholder input. And obviously the statute 916 required input, for example, from PBH. I'd like to know what their involvement has been thus far with input into the strategic plan, and not just those folks, but also I'd like to have maybe a little better idea about the stakeholder groups, because I know that we've had some concerns brought to us that I'd like you to address, and that is input from consumers and families, as well as maybe some people who were on some of the waiting lists for services as well. Are we getting that input now? When are we going to get that input? And also, if you wouldn't mind answering the PBH question there.
As I said the last time, getting stakeholder involvement is always a challenge to make sure that we are trying to get representative feedback from folks. In developing the strategic plan, we did have a relatively short period of time, and so we did a sort of a broadcast method of trying to get input, which was to post it on the internet, get feedback from folks in that way or written feedback that they might send in, as well as using our established advocacy and stakeholder groups to get that information out. We relied a great deal on them and sort of consolidating the input from their memberships to get to us. So we got that level of stakeholder input. Was that perfect? No, it was not. But we tried to get as broad input from the resources that we had as possible. Our hope going forward, and I talked about that overarching sort of advisory committee that we're trying to establish, is to have that stakeholder input represented on that committee, but also acknowledging that we will probably never get it totally right. And to be able to have at each of those meetings an open opportunity, an open mic opportunity for people to come and share their issues or their concerns with us so that we are knowledgeable about that and get that feedback as well. I think we want to be open to making changes as we need to in the strategic plan as we go forward, hence the title initial. But that would be, I think we see that as our primary mechanism for getting feedback going forward. As I mentioned, we have a number of committees that we're setting up, and we are committed to having stakeholder representation on that. Part of, again, our challenge is to identify the folks to serve on those committees, but but I think we have a process that we can recruit and do the best that we can with that. With PBH, we were in the same sort of time crunch as they did. We did get feedback from them in a written form. They also had an opportunity to interface with through their membership with the NC Council. We certainly interface with them on an ongoing basis as issues come up, and we would certainly expect to do that in the future. Can I say they agreed with everything that's in here? No, probably not. But I think that we certainly value their input, and we'll continue to do so.
Now, let me. I just have a few more questions here, Mr. Chairman. But in action step 4.1, I had a question with regard to, and this is kind of just following on our conversation you just had, in terms of the executive management team under that section. Could you please give us maybe a little a better description or the membership of that team, and whether or not you envision that team, that executive management team, having any consumers of services or families having a role in that team. And the reason why I ask about the executive management team is because within the strategic plan, it seems to me, unless I'm missing something, that there's some significant oversight roles and decision-making roles that entity is going to play.
Like I said, we right now, as we speak, have a proposal that we're floating to major stakeholder groups on how that group should be constituted. What we have put out there is that there be very clear representation of provider groups, of families and consumers, and especially we wanted to be sensitive to making sure that we got input from the local level as well. And not just folks from state-level organizations, so we have that reflected as well. Really, the majority of that committee is stakeholders. Participation of the department, I mean, I think we see this committee as a committee where, yes, we provide information, but it's also an opportunity for us to hear from the stakeholder groups. So the majority of that group are the various stakeholder groups. I think the conversation we're having right now is exactly how to divide that up so that people feel they have adequate representation. Again, I'm not sure that we'll ever get that perfect, and we hope that having that open mic opportunity will allow people who feel they don't have a seat at the table to at least come and raise their concerns with us.
Right. Well, as you mentioned, of course, and the open mic is great, but I think that, you know, there's also concern from a consumer side that when you have a decision-making entity, for example, like what we're talking about, the executive management team, that there's a consumer voice at that table, because that makes quite a bit of difference. let me just try to move on to two other things real quickly. If you could elaborate for me, and I think this is an action step 5.2. You talk about the development of consumer outcomes and system performance indicators. Can you kind of tell us, could you sort of elaborate on that, on what types of criteria you're going to use to that these outcomes will be based on? And maybe, again, add in there how the consumer's view will bear on that as well.
This will probably be a little bit of a short-term, long-term kind of a response. Right now, we have data that we're collecting that is available to us that we can report on. We also have contracts that have specific outcome and performance measures that we need to respond to. So probably short term, we will be pulling from information that we have and things that we have to report on. But going forward, what we want to do is to create some kind of, number one, change the outcome measures that we have to be more reflective of how is this impacting people's lives, and actually make that part of what our contract is. But the other piece is that we probably need to start collecting some different data to be able to report on some of those things. And so our hope is to start at one place initially, but to, as I said, convene this committee and include stakeholders and consumers around what should those measures look like going forward. I think the plan has something by the early spring that we would have that committee going. I think our intent really is to start that sooner so that we can identify at least an initial set of outcomes that we can be reporting to you and to the public, and then be planning forward so that if we have an opportunity to add some outcome and performance measures into the next contract starting in July, that we have an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I think that's going to be just a critical piece, and certainly we want to have some input to that as that moves forward and as you develop your proposals on that. Let me maybe move off the plan for a second, just ask a couple of quick questions. It's my understanding, and I'm probably not asking this question correctly, so maybe somebody could ask it better, but I understand there's some concerns that are out there with regard to the guardianship issue and their ability to interact with the new entities. I want to get your take on that, your response to that.
When we were all discussing 916 back a few months ago, we recognized then that there were going to be some issues with guardianship. Moving into an MCO environment, we do have to create that that boundary between MCOs being guardians of the same folks whose care they are managing. So we knew up front that we would need to come back to you in the short session with some proposals around how we could address that issue. There is the larger issue that we've had for quite some time, and that is the resources around which we support guardianship and how we should do that in an effective way. So we hope that we can also include some options or proposals in May as well. There is a particular instance related primarily to PBH, and that is related to a court ruling that occurred in Rowan County that has been interpreted as limiting their ability to even contract out guardianship. Most of the LMEs right now do not have guardianship, but they are able to contract that out to entities to provide that. PBH, because of this court ruling, believes that they are not able to do that, so they are in a difficult or a different position than some of the other LMEs. Again, I think that is something that we have got to look at, and whether or not there's some kind of remedy that we can have in the short session around how to handle that.
Well, will you be able to bring your proposals before this oversight committee later in the spring prior to? I see some heads nodding yes. So, okay, good. And I guess just the last issue, and this is one that comes up from time to time, and if you just wouldn't mind clarifying, in your follow-up from the October meeting, we're talking about a number of things that the LMEs can contract out, and as I recall, I may be recalling it incorrectly, but it seemed to me that there was an understanding that case management, if they so chose, and they may not so choose, but that the LMEs could in switching over to waiver, could contract that out, and that the department would not tell them that they could not, but obviously it would be up to them. Am I stating that correctly in terms of what the department is saying?
I'll start, and then I'll let Kelly, the expert, take over. But case management in the managed care world does not exist. The functions of case management are a number, and the legislation did say that there were a couple of those functions that are typically associated with case management that could be contracted out. Again, from the department standpoint, what those MCOs decide to contract out is entirely up to them. We haven't encouraged or discouraged. They have to have the tools in place to be able to manage. We know of one MCO that's looking at maybe contracting out some of that. Again, I think many of these MCOs are early enough in the process that they're still analyzing what is it that we feel comfortable contracting out. But we have not encouraged or discouraged them contracting out anything.
Okay, but just to follow up on that, those elements, as you mentioned, that used to fall, or certain elements that used to fall under case management, that would be applicable in a waiver environment to be potentially contracted out should the LMA do so, all of those are not necessarily included on the list that you've provided for us this morning, right?
Under the federal authority and in the Medicaid contract, the LMEs are required to provide care management and care coordination for special health care populations, much like CCNC does. So they're required to identify these individuals, assure that they have assessments to any kind of specialty care beyond and above behavioral health and rehabilitation services. They're required to assure that the individual has a treatment plan, and then they are required to have ongoing care management oversight of the individual. So the House Bill 916 does say that that treatment plan development and any linking to services that may go on with that treatment plan development can be subcontracted out to beyond the LME to other agencies. So that is on Dr. Melcher's list of the things that could be subcontracted out, and the LME would still be meeting their contractual responsibilities.
Okay. And maybe we can get from you in writing later. I would appreciate having maybe a little more exhaustive list on everything that is that the LMA would have the potential to contract out. It would be very helpful to me going forward if I could get that from you. Thank you.
Are there any questions from any other members of the committee? Senator Hartzell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Really just two questions. One, do we have in our packets a copy of this strategic plan? I haven't been able to locate one, and Co-Chair Dollar was speaking of.
It's not in the packet, but we can electronically send it to any of you who have your computers or get it to you at a later time.
If we could get that, I'd appreciate that. And secondly, I'm not quite sure how to ask this question, but very recently, I know a little bit about it, the service provider in the northwestern part of the state, New River, essentially dissolved or collapsed in effect. What, if any, impact has that had on Smoky Mountain? I mean, how is that affecting the plan for development, particularly in Smoky Mountain, or where is the department on that? That's because there's some contracts out there that really with New River that some counties are saying don't exist. I mean, they're essentially saying there's no pre-audit, and as a consequence, we don't have to pay anything. And, I mean, where is that? What's the status of that matter, if you know?
There's kind of two questions there. What's the status and how does it relate to the MCO? But in terms of how it would relate to the MCO, Smoky is not yet an MCO, but they certainly, because New River was one of their providers, have moved very aggressively to ensure that other providers have been able to step in and take over that service provision. And that's been very concerted effort, I think has been a successful effort in having that transition occur. I think there are still conversations about what the audit will find and who's responsible for what, but I think there have been good conversations between Smokies and the counties and the auditors, so I would certainly expect that to have a positive resolution.
Just to follow up, when does that audit, when do you anticipate that audit's being completed?
We'll have to. I can get you the exact time frame. I'm not entirely sure.
Further questions from members of the committee? Senator Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noticed on your membership list you have CFO and CEO from one hospital. Has that, and I know in some of the areas we're talking about maybe probably as many as 15 hospitals, has that been a troublesome or, I mean, if you would just give me some indication of how you would, because I know there's certainly differing opinions in some from hospital to hospital.
Senator Bingham, we're still on Medicaid managed care waivers. Was your question having to do with that or with the Medical Care Advisory Committee?
Well, the Medical Care Advisory Committee on the membership list that I had on this sheet that I have, if you would just touch on that, I'd appreciate it.
That's our next topic.
Okay. If that's what you wish.
Are there any other questions from members of the committee for Dr. Melcher, Ms. Crosby? Hearing none, thank you very much. Appreciate your input and for coming back and briefing us today, and I'm sure we'll ask you to come back again. I see that most of the people who were standing have had a chance to sit down, and the invitation is still open if you'd like to come up and have a seat, those of you who are standing, but please beware, this is not a give-me-the-mic moment, but you can certainly come up if you'd like. Next on our agenda is the Medical Care Advisory Committee, to be addressed by Melanie Bush and Dr. Karen Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're going to need a few minutes to pull up the presentation. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Melanie Bush. I'm an assistant director at the Division of Medical Assistance. One of my duties at the DMA is to coordinate the activities of the Medical Care Advisory Committee. I've been asked to speak today briefly to describe the Medical Care Advisory Committee and its functions before Dr. Smith here, who is our chair, will talk more about the substance of the Medical Care Advisory Committee. So briefly, I'm going to give you a quick overview of the purpose, the membership, and the process that DMA uses to move forward on the recommendations of the MCAC, as we call it. The purpose of the MCAC is set forth in federal regulation. 42 CFR 431.12 says that a state plan, a Medicaid state plan, must provide for the Medical Care Advisory Committee to advise the Medicaid agency on health and medical care services. The committee must have the opportunity to participate in policy development and program administration and also further the participation of recipients in the overall Medicaid program. So essentially what the MCAC does is provide a public forum to discuss the Medicaid program in its entirety. It's not limited to clinical policy or a specific issue, but rather crosses all aspects of the Medicaid program, including clinical policy, rate setting, budget, and budget reductions, which is why I assume we've been asked to speak today, recipient and provider services, program integrity, information technology, and any administrative issues. All of these come before the MCAC, either in physical presentations or in written reports. The membership of the MCAC is also pretty prescriptive and set forth in federal regulation. The agency director or state higher state authority appoints the members. Here in North Carolina, the Secretary of DHHS appoints all the MCAC members. DMA coordinates the nomination process. We solicit nominations from professional associations, individuals, advocacy groups, community organizations, and the like, and forward those to the Secretary for consideration. Members are appointed on a rotating basis as defined in the CFR for 3-year periods so that there's overlapping terms for continuity, and members serve no more than 3 consecutive terms. The composition of the membership is also set forward in the federal regulations. The committee must include board-certified physicians and other representatives of health professions that are familiar with the needs of low-income population and their resources, members of consumer groups, including Medicaid recipients, consumer organizations, cooperatives, and consumer-sponsored prepaid plans, for example, and then also the director of public welfare department or the public health department, whichever does not head the Medicaid agency. Of course, here in North Carolina, we have a head of public welfare and of health department, in addition to a director. But we do have representation on our board from the DSSs and the public health departments. Our membership panel is up to 20 members. In compliance with GS-143B-10, we have representation from all 13 congressional districts. The Secretary has also received approval from the Governor, as set forth in statute, to appoint an additional 7 at-large members. We also work to ensure diverse representation by race, gender, consumers, and the provider mix. We began appointing new board members in March of 2011, and this has been an ongoing process. The nominations, as you can see, are from a diverse representation of provider and advocacy organizations, community health care association, local health directors, the pharmaceutical association, North Carolina Bar, Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, the North Carolina Hospital Association, et cetera. This is just a snapshot of who is actually serving on our panel. It's a diverse mix of folks. We have 3 physicians, hospital CFO and CEO, Medicaid recipient, behavioral health providers, home health and personal care providers, public health director, division of social services director, skilled nursing facility, et cetera. All of these folks have experience with the Medicaid program and bring a unique perspective. They also are diverse in their scope in terms of location and experience. And this is just the membership list for your reference. We do have 2 vacancies in the congressional districts, and we have 6 at-large members. I'm not going to go through this here, but this is the list of the folks who are on the panel and do participate. Our process is to hold public meetings. The committee is subject to open meeting laws. All of our meetings are published on our website with the date and time and location. If there's a conference call, those are posted as well. Our minutes are posted online. At our physical meetings, we do allot time for public comment. Folks are allowed to come on a first-come, first-served basis and generally have about 2 minutes to speak. These public comments are included in the minutes of each meeting, and we've had providers, we've had family members, we've had Medicaid recipients all have an opportunity to speak at these meetings. The meetings are set up to meet bi-monthly and generally last for about 3 hours. They are advisory only. This committee is advisory only to the secretary and the division director. They do not make policy, but their recommendations are taken into consideration by the division and the department. And all of this information is available online at our website, which I've included in your handouts. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Any of the members have any questions for Ms. Bush? If not, Senator Bingham, let's go back to your question now, and you'd like to pose it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do I need to repeat that, or did you?
Yes, please.
Okay, if you would, the number of hospitals and the variation in intent and focus, et cetera, and I guess the difficulty in picking someone to represent. If you would, just talk a bit about this, because I could see this as a lot of difficulty on your side of this.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Bingham. We actually do have representation that was put forward by the North Carolina Hospital Association. Their nominee is Greg Gumbar, who is the CFO of Carolina Medical Center in Charlotte. He is a member of the North Carolina Hospital Association, as is Casey Cooper, who is the CEO of the Cherokee Hospital for the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Indians. So they are represented on this panel, I think, pretty well by both of those gentlemen. We do rely on the nominations of the Hospital Association, so we trust that they are happy with their representation.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. I just was curious because I could certainly see that being a potential serious problem as far as but anyway, it sounds like you've made a strong approach and sensible at what you've done. Thank you very much.
Dr. Smith?
Thank you. I do appreciate the opportunity to come and present what we are doing with the MCAC. In regard to the last question that was actually asked, I've been in practice in Hope County for 22 years now. I have served with the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians. I've served with the North Carolina Medical Society, as well as done quite a bit of work through the DMA over the course of the past several years. So we hope that our representation in conjunction with our other community, the committee members, will assist us in reviewing the role of MCAC. Now, it's interesting. MCAC has had a recent change in this past year, recognizing the task that we have been given. We are to advise the Secretary of Health and Human Services on their recommendations to fill the current projected budget shortfall. We recognize the pressure that Medicaid places on the state budget, and therefore we're also looking at long-term strategies and so that we can move forward. The MCAC process has changed, as I had mentioned. I've served on the committee for several years now. We have, since this year, opened it up to have more public input, and I can tell you that we are pleased with the information that we receive from other entities that are presenting. The meetings are face-to-face, but we also have interim meetings on the telephone conferencing, and we're also utilizing Google Internet. We receive quite a bit of information from DMA in written format. We are often given resources of background materials, allowing us to have focused discussions. We recognized early on that the task before us was somewhat grand. So it was determined that we needed to develop a consensus in regarding to our guiding principles and how we would approach each of the programs and budget issues that were placed before us. So we did develop a consensus. I'm going to go through that. We also looked at some different options for the short-term budget issues. Our guiding principles. And this is important because we needed to have a consensus in regard to how we were reviewing each of the programs. We needed to pursue those changes and strategies that were based upon their ability to increase equality, decrease unnecessary utilization using evidence-based medicine. We prefer to have a targeted rate reductions and targeted program modifications. We were trying to avoid service eliminations across the board. and consider the benefits of the impact on the primary care. Every effort has been made to preserve access to primary care, expand access to community care in North Carolina, and other primary care models that use the proven clinical management protocols to manage patient conditions. One of the aspects that I ask that we certainly appreciate is make sure that we are maintaining access, that we are maintaining quality, and that we continue to have efficiency, and recognizing that Medicaid, the provision of medical care has become so convoluted that we needed to try to make our processes a tad bit simpler in terms of implementation. The guiding principles, again, we need to limit impact on our life-saving procedures, but ensure that Medicaid protocols are consistent with other payers. Consider reducing the allowable number of visits by service with appropriate prior authorization criteria for higher need patients. We needed to manage our drug classes equitably and consider eliminating some drug classes. We need to standardize the rates for the same services across like programs. Important, we need to review what we pay and how we pay. And so we considered alternative rate methodologies. Therefore, we reviewed code limits, we reviewed case rates, global rates, and a series of other type of methodologies. We recognize that these are going to have an impact in terms of improving the quality and utilization equations for both the patient and provider behavior changes. And I can't emphasize in regard to behavior changes. That is going to be for all of those who are involved, and that includes the provider, that includes the patients, that includes our vendors that we're utilizing. And so there will need to be a change in how we are providing care, and that is a behavior change. We continue to support the person-centered care and services with community options and placements that can be supported with evidence that they do reduce the facility-based options. And we need to make sure that we're maintaining and protecting the safety nets that are already in existence throughout the state. So some of the options that have been considered through the MCAC, and certainly not that have been embraced but are considered, payment and rates. We have looked at rate reductions across the board. We reviewed that discussion, and we also looked at the targeted option. The alternative payment methodologies, as I had stated before, with global funding in terms of case rates, also utilizing more of the per member per month strategy, and utilization of incentives. We certainly want to make sure that we continue to recognize those programs that are actually allowing us to achieve the proven outcomes in regard to morbidity and mortality that we desire. We also reviewed administrative fees, what can be done in that regard. We looked at our billing codes, recognizing that we're going to have a change in our payment system going to ICD-10 very soon, and so we have reviewed those issues. Other options that we've considered, including that of program modifications as well as service eliminations, optional program eliminations, increased use of prior approvals. We've looked at restrictions on drugs and services, and also the increased use of independent assessment and visit limits. Some of the other options that we considered, given the remaining time constraints that we have in this current fiscal year, rejected as options to fill the shortfall, large across-the-board rate reductions. In addition, wholesale elimination of all optional services. It's in the opinion of the group that massive rate reductions and optional service eliminations would detrimentally impact recipients and the provider networks that serve them. The success of the North Carolina Medicaid program is noted to be the willing, qualified providers that are in this state, and we want to make sure that we continue to preserve that working relationship. If we move forward to our short-term recommendations, and again, only these have been considered, again, no across-the-board rate reductions. They should be targeted. Convert hospital outpatient imaging to a fee schedule. Reduce the outpatient hospital's other services that are provided. Modify the private duty nursing rates. Move to global funding methodology and case rates. restructure the emergency department payments for non-emergency room, non-emergent care, implement specialty networks, the specialty pharmacy networks, and certainly expand the 340B pharmacy program participation, implement clinical restrictions on mental health drugs, and increase the home health management by the Community Care of North Carolina. Those are the major principles that we have reviewed. They continue to be discussed amongst the committee members. And if I can answer any questions today, I'll be more than happy to do so.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. Chairman Dollar.
Thank you, Chairman Pate. Let me say just right up front, we certainly thank the group for all of your hard work. The MCAC has put in a tremendous amount of number of hours and a great deal of consideration, and I think I was over sort of visiting in the back of the room for one or two of those sessions, and I appreciate your the work of the committee, and if you could transmit that the next time the committee meets, our appreciation. We thank you for doing that. But even more so, I think we appreciate, I think I'm certainly speaking for myself, and I think most of the people here, we warmly welcome your recommendation to avoid any large across-the-board rate reductions, because that's just incredibly problematic, both in terms of the approval process that would be required and also very problematic in terms of the impact on the system. And, of course, you being a physician and others would understand that, as well as a number of providers. And we also appreciate your recommendation with respect to rejecting any wholesale elimination of optional services, because in most, if not all, instances, we would simply be driving up our emergency room costs down the road, and that really doesn't get us where we need to be. One thing that I would add is that, and I know this wasn't in your purview, the MCAC, you've brought recommendations to the secretary and to the committee today. Coming out of the meeting from governmental ops, I think it was very evident that what we are facing this year is really a one-time problem. It's one-time money that we're really looking for the current year. And, of course, in my view and the view of some others, a good deal of that's actually been driven by liabilities coming from past years that have to be paid. And, of course, obviously that was outside of what you were looking at. And I'm sure we'll get into those as we talk about the budget with the later panel with the secretary. I do one thing. Let me ask one overall question, because individual members may have questions about some of these individual recommendations. But let me just ask one overall question with regard to the recommendations. Were these particular 10 recommendations, were these, how much of a consensus were these recommendations? Were all 10 of these consensus recommendations from the group, or was it just maybe a majority? Was there a minority report, for example, or were there certain recommendations here that were maybe a little more contentious in the group at the end when these were being made? If you could elaborate on that, it would be helpful.
I can. If we look at the short-term recommendations, the group certainly came to a consensus in regard to no across-the-board rate reductions, and certainly to continue with the targeted. When we look at some of the other areas, the group does seem to, the majority, when we look at number six, in regard to restructuring the emergency department payments for the non-emergent care, we certainly recognize the value in regard to expanding the 340B pharmacy program, as well as the implementing the specialty pharmacy network. So there's quite a bit of value in that regard. We also recognize the importance from a clinical standpoint in regard to the use of the mental health drugs, and recognize that discussion is a quite a broad discussion and really does need to be evaluated before it can be fully implemented. So the group has placed importance on that. I think also when we move into number five, for example, move to the global funding methodology and case rates, we're looking at more of future payment schemes, particularly in the environment of accountable care organizations and how physicians and other providers are restructuring in regard to making sure that we're maximizing outcome. And so those are more of future thoughts that we need to be prepared for in the Medicaid system. We also look at our value that has been placed on community care network, and I cannot overemphasize that. The community care network, shall I say, is North Carolina's baby. North Carolina is well recognized for the community care network. We know it has proven effectiveness in our own community, and that is the project that we hope that the division continues to expand upon, and I believe the providers are willing and ready to allow that expansion, and we're ready to work to see the proven benefits that will come out of CCNC. And so, again, the majority of the list the group seems to have consensus on, is there across-the-board agreement on everything? No, there's not across-the-board agreement. But we have certainly had quite a bit of discussion, and we definitely have further discussion that will take place in the upcoming weeks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I might have one follow-up. I'm assuming we're going to be receiving, I don't see it in my materials, the staff may have already received it, but some of the details behind these 10 recommendations, can we get those from you?
Yes.
Appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Questions from other members of the committee? Senator Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Smith, on the information that you listened and talked about and discussed, you talked about case rates and global rates, etc. Can we get copies, or could I get copies of that information? I'd be very interested in just looking that over, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. We'll provide that.
Thank you, ma'am.
Further questions from members of the committee?
Chairman.
Senator Blake.
In your advisory committee status, do you look at greater use of the rural help center type program that provides care to a lot of people but still not utilized as much as it probably could be? Do you look at that as a possible part of your responsibility?
Yes, we do. And actually, one of the other roles that I personally play is with the North Carolina Institute of Medicine, as well as with the rural health group. And so recognizing that there is value with other programs and in recognizing that we can certainly have a lot more accomplished if we can coordinate with other programs throughout the state. So absolutely, yes, we do look at the other resources.
Just a follow-up. Yes. You refer to rate as you talk about cost. Is that different from fee for service, or is that the same thing?
I would like to go ahead and defer that for the Secretary as part of his response, if that's okay.
Representative Avila, did you have a question?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Having visited a client in the private duty nursing program, I noticed there's been a cut, but it's a very small cut. That program not only benefits the person who's receiving the nursing services, but it plays a major role in how the family survives. Is there going to be any negative impact to people receiving the services with this cut?
I do not know the I would not be able to respond in regard to the full impact. However, when the committee considers the different options that are placed before us, That is part of what we're looking at. What is the impact on the family, the patient, the community, the other providers of care? And so that's part of the role of the committee. And that information we can certainly obtain from DMA to assist us in that response.
Further questions? Senator Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Dr. Smith. Considering that North Carolina is not unique in the challenges that are faced, is there a national network of options and potential recommendations or solutions which you can access to help arriving at solutions?
Again, it's interesting that we have Community Care Network in North Carolina. One of the other things that I do is with the American Academy of Family Physicians and recently served as chair on practice enhancement and quality. And I had the opportunity of looking at programs throughout the United States. And invariably, in the course of our meetings, Community Care of North Carolina would be mentioned as a potential solution for other states. So we're actually the inventors of a program which other states are looking at for as a model to be used in their states. Now, in regard to what else are we looking at, just not CCNC type approach, yes, the division has provided us with other models of importance. Not only are they providing us with models that are good models, but they're also providing us with information of bad models. So we don't want to implement something in our state which has failed in another state. And so we are looking at resources from other areas. And I really don't want to say that we're limiting in regard to just in this country. In regard to technology, we have to keep in mind that there's a lot of international developments that are occurring, and so we have also had access to that information.
Further questions? Hearing none, Dr. Smith and Ms. Bush, we thank you very much for your participation today, and certainly this is something that we'll want to follow with interest. Members, our next and final segment before lunch will be our Secretary Lanier Counselor and some of his staff who have come forward to talk about the budget. While the people are coming forward, I just heard that the strategic plan will be distributed to all the members immediately after lunch. Those who wanted to, Senator Hartzell, you heard that the strategic plan is going to be distributed to everyone after lunch. It's being printed up now. We're ready for you, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the opportunity to provide the committee with an update on where we are on a number of budget issues. We will.
Excuse me for interrupting you. Could you introduce the members of the panel?
What I'll do, if it's okay, I'll just let them go down the line, introduce themselves, and what their position is. Karen.
I'm Karen Tomczak, the Department of Health and Human Services CIO.
Jim Slate, Director of the Department's Division of Budget Analysis.
Steve Jordan, Director of Mental Health, Developmental Disabilities, and Substance Abuse Services.
Sherry Bradshaw, Director, Division of Social Services.
John Price, I'm the Director of the Office of Rural Health and Community Care.
Jeff Engel, State Health Director and Division Director of Public Health.
Thank all of you for being here. Please continue, Secretary.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What the approach we want to take today, and I think we've given each of you, if you haven't gotten it, should be getting it, a copy of a list of questions that Fiscal Research submitted to us that you would like to have answered. And what we're going to try to do is just give a brief overview of the answer to these questions, and obviously it'd be certainly happy to discuss any questions or answer any further questions you have. Let me make just a couple comments to start with. Obviously, we have been working diligently with the budget for DHHS overall in trying to accomplish the goals in this fiscal year. Outside of Medicaid, I think we will be hitting budget targets. We will discuss a little bit about our continued struggles with mental health payments, which dates back a couple years, that has been a carryover unpaid bills each year that we're trying to contend with and trying to reduce, and it depends on the year. We will talk about what we've done in our administrative cuts and those things. So we're going to give you a quick rundown of everything, but the issue I know that is constantly in the media is about the Medicaid budget, and I will give you a little more insight into that. You've just heard from the Medical Care Advisory Committee and some of the ideas that they have and their recommendations, and that committee is a committee that's required by the federal government and CMS. We've expanded some, put extra expertise on it, and given them the charge of helping us come up with ideas. With respect to the question about information, I think we're all keep our ears to the ground on what's happening in other states and what's happening in the private market, and we look for opportunities to try new things. There's a number of things that we're working on to try to reduce costs and create savings. It's not even a part of the budget. We are working with our facilities. You know, the facilities traditionally have had about a $20 million deficit, which we've had to make up from other sources within the department. And right now with our facilities, we're trying to reduce and hopefully potentially eliminate agency staffing, reduce the overtime, and actually hire staff. It is a challenge, but we're working on doing that. If we can accomplish that goal, we'll save a couple million dollars a year. We've got a financial management system we're putting in place. It's gone and started to generate information now. By the 1st of January, we'll have much better data to identify how the hospitals and facilities compare and what's working and what's not, and reduce costs there. We're having conversations with the controller's office and how we can put an automated timekeeping system in our facilities. And keep in mind, about 12,000 of our employees are in facilities, and right now all the timekeeping is manual. There's errors made, tracking overtime, getting the right federal match. All that is a very complicated system that's done manually, and we believe that we can net about $6 million a year in savings if we can get an automated timekeeping system in our facilities, and we could do that relatively rapidly if we get the necessary approvals. We are looking for ways to consolidate purchasing, and just on transcription services and laboratory services, we're looking at saving almost $400,000 a year. So there's a lot of things that we're doing that's not mandated by the budget, but are still trying to help us get things under the control. But when it comes to Medicaid, it's a much more challenging issue. So let's start with the questions, and the reason I have a number of the staff here, folks who work on this, and let them make some of the various presentations. We'll answer questions you seem appropriate. It may be a good idea if we kind of ran through this and to make sure we cover everything, and then have questions with whatever the chair desires. So if I may, let me start with the first couple questions, and I'm going to ask Jim Slate, who's the head of our budget analysis, to start with question number one, talking about basically our administrative reductions and position reductions. And then we'll move from, and also we'll talk about I'll talk about where we are at nonprofit, and then I'll move into Medicaid.
And one more of your panel just came forward, if he would introduce himself.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm Lucky Welsh. I'm Director of Division of State Operated Healthcare Facilities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the items in the budget bill this last time was a reduction in positions and administrative savings throughout the department to come up with $7.6 million. You'll see in the special provision that's a part of the handout that as a part of that process, we were to exempt mental health facility positions as well as Medicaid positions, and in doing so, we basically just proportionally increased the reductions for the other divisions. And what I have lined out for you here is a reduction in those divisions in state dollars, and I'll quickly run through those for you. In central administration, we eliminated 274,000 in salary and fringes in three positions, as well as $100,000 of general operating. In the Division of Aging and Adult Services, we eliminated 24,000 of general operating. The Division of Child Development, 68,000 of general operating. In the Division of Public Health, 1.6 million in salary and fringes and 31 FTE, as well as over $1 million in university contracts. In the Division of Social Services, 169,000 of state dollars in salary and fringes and 5 FTE, and then 663,000 of general operating. In the Division of Medical Assistance, we eliminated $1.6 million out of the Health Choice Program, and we were able to do this because of savings we are realizing from moving the administration of Health Choice from the state health plan to the department. If you'll turn over to the next page. Then in the Division of Blind, Deaf, and Hard of Hearing, we eliminated 82,000 of salary and fringes, 3.5 positions, 27,000 in general operating. In mental health, absent the facilities, we eliminated 845,000 in general operating. In health service regulation, 483,000 in salary and fringes in 7 positions. And then to round out the reductions in the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, 424,000 in salary and fringes, 3 FTEs, and 68,000 in general operating. I would also like to note that there was another reduction item number 21 in the budget bill that required us to reduce 25 positions through administrative efficiencies, and we've also accomplished that effort.
Mr. Chairman, I've also just asked folks to hand out one other piece of information that I think just supplements this, because I wanted everyone to understand about positions, and they'll pass in that sheet out. But let me kind of give you an idea of, I think you had 135 or 151 positions or something like that we've actually eliminated. And the question has arisen, well, you had 1,600. Why didn't you eliminate more positions? And I think this information will help you understand that some. We start out with 1,621 vacant positions. And of the vacant positions, about 228 of them are positions that are 100% federally funded. So eliminating those positions doesn't do anything for us except lose federal dollars that we would have. 25 positions was eliminated as a result of the one of the provisions in the budget. Another 16 was eliminated as a result of administrative efficiencies. 47, almost 48 positions were transferred to the Department of Public Instruction as a result of transferring the schools for the deaf and blind to them, so 47 positions left there. We had 67 vacant positions in Medicaid, and we're have been trying to fill a number of those positions. It's unfortunate, but not many people want to work for Medicaid because of the pressures and the scale of salary. 947 of our vacant positions were in facilities. And you may ask, well, if you have 947 positions and you don't need them, why don't you get rid of them? Well, the problem is we do need them. We're using the money in those positions to fund overtime and fund agency staffing in order to keep the facilities staffed at the level that we're required to keep them staffed at. That's what I mentioned earlier, a real effort we have going on right now to try to reduce agency staffing, which is more expensive, reduce overtime, which obviously is more expensive, and actually fill the positions. And so in your budget provision, you ask us to avoid reducing positions in medical assistance or in our state facilities. So whenever you take that 1,621 and you subtract the federally funded positions, the positions that were eliminated in other provisions, what we transferred to DPI and what's in Medicaid and mental health, there were only 289 vacant positions left. And those are scattered across the entire department. For instance, Central Administration has 35 of those, but Central Administration is our budget office, it's our controller's office, it's our personnel office, it's our IT office, it's rural health, and a number of others. So you can see that there's not a lot of vacant positions in any one place. And go on down the line. So while we did eliminate a number of positions, we did not try to achieve the 250 because it basically would have eliminated most any positions we have outside of the original list. And I just want to give you that information so you can kind of understand how those positions line up. And I also will tell you that about 70% of our positions have some federal funding in them. And so when you're talking about eliminating position, you may get 20% of that money or you may get 80% of that money, but in most cases, there's some federal dollars in every position we do because of the way the cost allocations work. I'll move on to the nonprofit just to say that there is a reduction of...
Mr. Secretary, or Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Let me ask just one quick clarifying question, if I might, on the positions, and it's probably here in the material, and I'm just not seeing it. Mr. Secretary, at this point, how many FTEs, how many total FTEs have been eliminated?
I believe during this budget cycle it's 151 or something like that total. Hold on a minute. 157.
Thank you.
Please go ahead, Mr. Secretary.
All right. With respect to nonprofit, we are working to get the $5 million. We've had several approaches to how we're going to do this. One of our issues is a whole lot of the nonprofit, what's classified as nonprofit money, is in three areas. One is the CCN, CPMPM, which actually, as we enroll more, that's not a good place to cut. Two is Piedmont Behavioral Health, PBH, which is expanding under the waiver program. That's not a good place to take a lot of money. And third is Smart Start, which has already had considerable reductions. And so we're trying to figure out how to allocate the $5 million among all the other nonprofits to have the least detrimental impact. We're in that discussion with the budget office as well as the governor's office, and we will finalize that. But we will achieve that $5 million in savings. Now let's talk about Medicaid. There are a number of questions in Medicaid, and we've tried to put information in your packet to answer those, but let me just quickly summarize those questions. One is about federal approval. To accomplish the rate reductions and the other budgetary changes in Medicaid, there's about 45 state plan amendments that are required. We've had more than that in state plan amendments because some of them are policy that don't directly impact budget, but those are budget. We've had about 21 or so of those approved to date. Most of those approvals, about 20 of those approvals were received about 2 weeks ago. We're still waiting on other approvals. We're in negotiations with them on issues. Again, just so you remember the process, anytime we're going to change the Medicaid plan, we have to give 60-day notice to the Native Americans. And then once that 60 days runs, then we can file the state plan amendment with Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS. They have 90 days to respond. They can respond yes, they can respond no, or they can respond with questions, and usually it's questions. There's some discussion that goes on in that process normally. Once we answer any questions, it starts a new 90-day clock, and so sometimes, and with those 20, we got them approved in about a 90-day time frame after we had the notice. But there has been times it's taken 4 or 5 years to get approval, and that's always been an unknown in this process. And we do expect about $27 million of our budget that we can achieve because of waiting on these approvals. The second question asked about liabilities in Medicaid, and this is something that Representative Dollar mentioned earlier, and there's a chart on page 3 that shows we had 4 areas of liabilities, and there's a couple actually is not even on here, but the first one is paying back the quarterly payments for the over $300 million that was improperly drawn down from the feds that started back in 2008, and we discovered it early in 2009. But by then we had drawn down $300,000. It quite honestly probably helped the state get through that fiscal year because of cash shortfalls. But we're paying that back at $10 million a quarter, and that is unbudgeted. So we're having to come up with that $10 million wherever we can find funds. Secondly, there was an audit of personal care services provided in-home for the year 2005 to 2007. That was a $41 million repayment we had to make. Keep in mind, if they bill us for this and we don't pay it, then they just simply take it out of the next federal payment we receive, so we don't have options about do we pay it or not.
I will say that that figure started out closer to $74 million, and through negotiations we got it down to 41, so we reduced that liability from what they originally had proposed. Third, and this is something we actually didn't find out until after the budget had been finalized and you had gone home, and that is that under the Affordable Care Act, they're changing the way drug rebates are allocated. The rebates that go to the federal government and are allocated to the state, where we received $28 million less in rebates than what we originally had budgeted. So that was $28 million. And the other $9 million is other types of repayment shortfalls, costs that we incur, contractual costs, et cetera, that are not budgeted. So that's $120 million of basically one-time, well, the rebates are going to be recurring, but basically costs that has occurred this year that are unbudgeted. But we also have two receipts that we're going to get this year that were unbudgeted that total $83 million. So there's a net $37 million in costs there that are not budgeted that we're trying to deal with out of available funds. I will mention, I mentioned this at the last meeting, waiting on OAH to hear some of our hearings on PCS. We're paying out about $1.6 million a month in service costs there that are waiting for appeals to be heard. I do understand that OAH has begun doing mediation on some of those. There's several hundred, I think, that's gone to mediation since the last meeting. I think there's a couple thousand appeals that's been filed, and under the law, whenever a consumer files an appeal, we continue to pay for services until such time as the appeal is heard. And OAH basically ceased hearing appeals back in June because of a federal court case that was filed. And my understanding is the federal judge has finally scheduled a hearing for next week, so hopefully we'll get some resolution to that. But there are these costs there that we are having to cover that are not budgeted. The third question deals with the waiver. And this is the waiver about OAH and them having final agency decision. We did file that waiver request on August the 11th, gave 60-day notice on August the 11th. The waiver was submitted on August the 11th, 60 days after we filed notice with the Native Americans. We did have questions. We have answered those questions. We are waiting now. The legislation says that changes January 1. It is a concern, obviously, if CMS does not approve this waiver on how we're going to deal with that, simply because if CMS says, no, you can't operate that way, and we do operate that way, whether or not we may have some federal repayment as a result of decisions made by OAH. So we're monitoring that closely and seeing what happens with that. Number four is about CCNC, and I think CCNC is making a presentation this afternoon. They had a savings to be made of $90 million this year, another $90 million next year. Because of the timing of enrollment and because of the timing of implementing some of these things, we're estimating now that they will save at least $51 million this year, but we're saying we believe over the biennium of the 2 years they'll actually exceed the two-year target by $20 million or so. And, again, I think Dr. Dobson will be giving you a presentation on that later. But the first year of the biennium is an issue. The legislation says that I shall reduce rates across the board by another 2% and or reduce services in order to make up any shortfall they have. My concern is I think they will meet their target in the biennium. So I think it is a kind of a one-year problem if they can't hit the $90 million. And I'm concerned that any reduction in rates right now will destabilize what has become a pretty unified effort among providers to help hit these targets. So I need guidance from you about whether or not I move forward with that. Question number five dealt with pharmacy and some changes in pharmacy. We expect to we've negotiated with the pharmacists in the state, and we expect to hit that target maybe plus a little bit. Question number six, inflationary increases. We have gone forward with inflationary to adjust inflationary increases. However, the inflationary figure that was in the budget we can't achieve for several reasons. One is that over $9 million of that is cost adjustments the federal government requires us to do, which we can't do. A part of that had to do with pharmacy, but as a part of our negotiations with pharmacy, we are covering that, so it will be saved, just not as a as an adjustment to or a freezing of drug prices. Third is that a part of that inflation factor dealt with the case mix, the case mix reimbursement in skilled nursing facilities, nursing homes. Some years ago, we moved to a case mix, which meant that the sicker the folks are in your facility, the reimbursement rate goes up. If they're not as sick, it goes down. So the rate can go up or down, and sometimes it goes up overall, sometimes it goes down overall. But the number that was in inflation dealt with that case mix funding, the anticipation that there would be an increased acuity level for the folks in the facilities. So to eliminate that number meant that we were going to abandon the case mix approach, which after having conversation with a number of members here was not your intent, and so we have not implemented anything to change that case mix, which is about $12 million that we would not achieve in that process. So we are going to achieve everything within the inflationary adjustment with the exception, I think, of those items. Question number seven dealt with the assessment on hospitals. We have submitted that SPA. We have gotten questions. We have been in conversation. And while CMS may not let us do it exactly the way we'd intended, we will substantially achieve those savings. And I will say that if you'll notice when I had unbudgeted revenue, there's $21 million there, that when we submitted the SPA, a cooperation, the hospital association, we submitted it to be effective January 1 as opposed to June 1, so that means we'll pick up $21 million in additional revenues for the first part of the year, which are unbudgeted, which will help us with our shortfall, even though as soon as we get approval on that. We do expect approval. Now, the hospital was 40-some million, and the budget number was 60-some, and the provision said that we could do other assessments on other willing providers. And when you do these assessments, it means you charge an assessment based upon their total business. You give them an increased rate based upon their Medicaid business. So unless they have a substantial amount of Medicaid consumers, it turns out to be a negative for them. So if it's a negative, provider groups generally aren't willing. And so we are having difficult identifying other groups. We have done, I think, CAPMR, DD providers, and we're still continuing to look for other folks that we can do that with. CABAs, we've determined in conversation with CMS and others that we can't qualify them individually. We'd have to do it across all mental health providers, and that becomes problematic with respect to the willing provider approach. Question number eight deals with the 1915 BC waiver, which is the PBH approach to providing mental health services. That is going on probably 2 or 3 months behind what we originally expected. I think we have to be a little flexible with the LMEs on this because this is a risk-based, different approach to how we do things, and we want to make sure we don't force them into something a month or two before they're ready and result in some failure in the system. And so it's coming along. I think we'll be pretty much on schedule as we get to the end of the fiscal year, but the actual implementation is going a little slower than what we had hoped. So the savings, there will be some savings there, but not as much as originally projected. Question number nine talks about provider reimbursement rates, the 2% across the board. In order to get a full 2%, we made the adjustment at 2.6%. That was effective on November 1st. We have not received all of the approval from CMS on this. We've received over half of them. We anticipate receiving the rest. We went on and implemented the provider rate adjustment November 1, even though we haven't received all the approvals, understanding that if we don't get the approvals, we'll have to reimburse providers for whatever rate adjustment we made where it's not approved. But trying to avoid having a larger budget hole or a larger percentage adjustment, we went on and made the decision to implement effective November 1. So we will achieve the full savings there. Question number 10, have we adjusted optional and mandatory services? And yes, we have, or we at least have SPAs in to do that. So all that's going to be a little later getting implemented because of the delay in getting approvals on all of it. But all that is in process, and while we won't achieve the full savings, primarily because of delays and or duplication of numbers in the budgeting process between rate cuts and optional services, that is all on track to take place. When I say that duplication, you know, the problem is when you determined how much would you save by modifying the service, that determination had originally been made based upon existing rates. So whenever you adjust the rates and then you adjust the services, you've got a duplication of savings based on that, and that is a part of the issue we have. What is the projected Medicaid shortfall for the current year, fiscal year? It's right now at about $139 million for all the different things we've talked about, delays in CMS, modifications to inflation, mandated federal requirements in inflation, other delays. So about $139 million. That also includes that net 30-some million that I showed you earlier of unbudgeted issues that we have to cover. So we're really talking about not a budget shortfall of $139. We're talking about a cash shortfall of $139. Some of it does relate to budget. Some of it is unbudgeted. So we are working to try to deal with that, and I'll just say again, we're trying to do everything we can to whittle that number down, working closely with CCNC, working closely with everyone else trying to whittle it down. There's only two ways that I can attempt to cover that entire hole within the Medicaid budget, and one is an across-the-board rate reduction of roughly 18%, because you have to do that big of annual reduction to achieve what we might save in the last 3 months of the year, or virtually eliminating all optional services other than pharmacy, which would not even get us to the $130 million. And again, I appreciate Representative Dollar's remarks, but I really need just guidance from you about, do we want to go down that road? If we do, I need to give notice next week and get started on that to try to get any substantial savings in the current year.
Mr. Secretary, could you pause just a second for Chairman Dollar to ask a question?
We are happy to give you some guidance on that. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, our guidance would be absolutely not. We have, as you have mentioned, for one thing, it would be very problematic in terms of a rate reduction. It would be very problematic in terms of CMS approval of any substantial reduction of optional services. So even if we travel down that road, as Mr. Secretary, you have rightly pointed out, the likelihood of CMS approval would be highly speculative and probably not forthcoming for most of that. We also, as has been mentioned, I think Mr. Watson had mentioned this at Governmental Ops Oversight last week, that a CMS with the 2% rate reduction, CMS has asked the department to fund, what, about $1 million rate study. I think that's very indicative of kind of where they are. From our perspective, we certainly do not want to see across-the-board rate reductions because of what it would mean, potentially mean for the system, you know, given that we've had rate reductions, much larger rate reductions that occurred back in 2009, which sometimes people sort of lose track of that. They shouldn't lose track of that. It does have a cumulative effect. And, of course, as we've mentioned, as you said, and as the MCAC has pointed out, major reductions in optional services simply drive people to what ends up being more costly care for us in the emergency room, and that's not helpful. It does seem to me, and so from that standpoint, I think you've got our guidance. Beyond that, as I see it, we do have an issue here that's essentially one-time funding issue, and that also plays into it. There's no need to reduce those things that are actually ongoing operational programs, and what we really have is a one-time issue. Now, we've had $83 million in unbudgeted money, and, of course, we were realizing that most of that was in there when we were doing the budget. We got to have some funds in there to see what's going to happen. Some programs are going to save more than you think. Other things are going to be delayed. Some things have been delayed. Some things have performed better than we thought. We also have $10 million in there. I don't know that it's mentioned here. Maybe it's mentioned in here somewhere, from the Health and Wellness Trust Fund that was designated to go to the CCNC goal to really, in effect, reduce that down to an $80 million goal initially. In terms of the language of the statute, it seems to me that we have to look at, I mean, that bill is a two-year budget, and clearly, for example, with respect to the CCNC provisions, the department is now projecting that we are actually going to substantially exceed the overall reductions when you look at the actual 2 years of the biennial budget. So I think we can get around whatever language needs to be gotten around. We get back to what's really, to in my view, more of a one-time issue that is driven primarily by payments that have to be made for liabilities that were incurred prior to the current administration and certainly prior to this General Assembly. And in that regard, as the department continues to work to find other savings, as you continue to analyze and we continue to analyze the report that we received today from the MCAC and take a look at those potential things. And as we move forward in the budget year, we're only a third of the way through at this point. As we get a better handle on what the actual number is, I think from our perspective, we will certainly be working with the department to see where we can come up with a sufficient number of one-time funds to resolve any cash problem for the current fiscal year, and do it as you've suggested and as we certainly support, a way that does not affect the quality of our Medicaid program. So if that is helpful to you.
That is extremely helpful to me. Thank you very much. And I will mention on the repayment of the $330 million, I just asked, I think we have two more installments that will be in the next fiscal year, and that's repaid. So we'll have successfully repaid that $330 million.
And Mr. Chairman, could I ask a couple of just quick Medicaid questions?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. One is, I would like, if you could get for us, send to us, in the inflation segment, I continue to hear the figure of, I think, $12 million as it regards case mix inflation. The information that I've been seeing on inflation with respect to nursing homes and their history doesn't come anywhere near $12 million. So what I would be interested in having at some point get some background on is the actual numbers behind that $12, $13 million so I can get a better handle on that, on how that – I mean, I still realize, you know, there's a budget amount there and we have to account for it, but specific to how that is being deemed as $12 million, I'd like to get a better handle on that and some of the numbers. And the other thing that I just want to ask real quickly about that you may want to can respond right now on, and that is the CAPMR assessment. I think that had not been submitted. If you could enlighten us on why we have not submitted that, I think that's maybe a $5 million savings or potential savings.
With respect to the $12 million, you know, obviously we use analytical software and that we've just started for the first time this year in trying to develop a budget, looking at budget trends, looking at aging numbers, population, all that kind of stuff. And so the $12 million in the inflation number would be a part of that determination. Obviously, with the budget, you're estimating based upon what you know, and you're right in that skilled nursing has been pretty flat budgetarily. And so while we're not going to modify the case mix for that $12 million, it depends on the case mix. We could end up not needing $12 million. We could end up with a surplus in that arena. So that's all a budgeted thing. But in our budget process and tools, they had determined that based upon all the factors that there would be a $12 million growth in that arena. Keep in mind that there's
I forget, $1 billion in long-term care or whatever, so in that cost. So I'm not saying skilled nursing, I'm saying overall. So the deal is all these numbers, looking at them at the end of 4 months, is still looking at what we had projected through our budgetary process that state budget involved with, your folks were involved with, and others. And so the deal is as we go through this year, we may find that we don't have a problem with that $12 million because it may not even need to be needed anyway, but that is a part of the process of going through the fiscal year.
Well, just to follow up on that just very briefly, to this point in the year, it's not a problem. Is that not correct? They're actually ahead, not behind, if I understand it correctly.
A report that I have is at this point in time, the case mix has been such that they're not. It is not a problem at this point in time.
Thank you.
With respect to your second question about the spa, I don't know whether it's been submitted or not. One of the issues, and this is the thing with the spas, is whenever you develop the spa and submit it, you want to try to develop something you think is going to be approved and work from there. And my understanding is there's only one other state that's gone down the road of an assessment on CAP-MRDD, and so I think there's been some development process in trying to do that. Second thing is we did work on spas that had the largest dollar impacts first and the ones that were easy to get in and hopefully easy to get approved. I do not know whether that spa's gone in or not. I think we only have had a couple spas that have not gone in at this point in time, and it's a part of the development process of getting those done.
Please continue. I think we're at question 12.
Question 12 relates to the $1 million transfer to Office Administrative Hearings. To date, I think we have transferred $382,000. Whenever we have these kind of processes, we try to develop memorandums of understanding of, okay, what are their responsibilities to us, what are our responsibilities to them. It's reported that as of last week or maybe even this week, while we have agreed on the MOU, the Office of Administrative Hearings have not yet signed it. I'm not sure why. I'll follow up on that and find out why. But so they have received a part of the money but have not received the full $1 million as we had agreed, I think, to pay it over the course of the year in installments. Keep in mind that it is 50% state, 50% federal, and we do have a deficit within our contractual dollars to try to do that, so we're paying the bills as we can and managing the budget. But I see no reason they won't get the $1 million. They've gotten $382,000 so far. Health Choice, happy to report that at this point in time, we're actually running in a surplus situation. We've estimated expenditures for the year of $323 million total dollars. Before budget reductions, there was $8.5 million reductions. So I think budgeted was $315 million. We have both federal receipts and appropriations, and right now we're estimating that we will have a small surplus in that and should not have to worry about freezing enrollment. Again, we're 4 months into the year. Enrollment could change. Different things happen, but right now we're on track with Health Choice. It should not be an issue and perhaps have a small surplus. That kind of concludes the Medicaid piece. I'm going to ask Steve Jordan, who heads up our Division of Mental Health, Developmental Disabilities, and Substance Abuse, to answer the next couple of questions related to the status of payments on mental health.
Go ahead, Mr. Jordan.
Thank you very much. We are now on page 8 of the handout, and as was previously stated by the Secretary, we are a group that for the past 3 years has ended with kind of some costs that needed to be carried over from year to year. With that has created some slow payment issues that we have with the LMEs. With that, where we are in our payment to the LMEs is we're basically a month behind in the two formats at which we pay them. We pay them one payment for their single stream or their service dollars, and then a second payment for their admin dollars. So right now, as of date, we are a month behind, and the next payment for the admin money would be a week from today. The next thing would be on schedule. We have come up with an administrative schedule on how we pay out for the division. Our first priority is the facilities to make sure that those things are paid on time so that the facilities can run properly. Then the next priority that we have is the LMEs. We take care of single stream funding and then admin as we go through that. And then we deal with the central administration of the division with payments. We would anticipate being back on schedule with the infusion of the money that would assist us to get back on schedule with our payment and to be in line with the budget from a year-to-year standpoint. With that, in the special provision that was put out for our budget, there was a fund balance swap that was required for the tune of $25 million mandatory and an additional $20 million that was to be highly encouraged to be swapped. If you would switch back to, there are two attachments in your document that refer to that. The first is attachment A, and it gives you LME by LME what the fund balance swap was for each one of them. In column one is their total payment, and then in columns, and the additional columns would be the fund balance swap in columns two and columns three, which was what we expected each one of them to spend on services in the community out of their fund balance. Attachment B is a form by which we track their expenses and the use of the fund balance on a month-by-month basis. And we gave you an example here that would show that from a the use for cash flow purposes that the LMEs have been using their fund balance to as cash flow for the delayed payments that we have been sending to them, and just wanted to advise you of that.
If I may just add, just to give you a little idea of why we have this cash flow issue in mental health, it actually dates back, again, several years. Back, I think, 2007, 2008, somewhere in there, we had two of our hospitals that lost their federal funding because of inspections or issues that CMS came in and said, you know, your immediate jeopardy, we're going to take away your federal funding. And so we couldn't close the hospital. So what was done was the facilities were continued to be operated using state funds, and we are talking about millions of dollars. Well, subsequently, with respect to Broughton, we filed an appeal. We won the appeal. We got that money back. But that did not happen with respect to Cherry. And so we lost millions of dollars during that process that we had to make up, and that got us behind, and we've basically been behind ever since. That plus the fact that our state hospitals have had been under have been over budget for a while, and many of our initiatives right now are bringing that much closer in. So there's been a, at the end of each year, unpaid bills that we'd carry over the next year, and while that's, we try to whittle that down, again, it depends on a number of issues, what success we have there. And I think if you look at the fund balances, again, you can see how that's being utilized. And the fact that as we are moving to the 1915 BC waiver, having, since they are going to be at risk, having substantial reserves is going to be important. So we want to take care as not to drain those reserves to a point that they don't have backup if they have bad months as a managed care organization. The next question relates to the process of the forensic facility on Dick's campus and doing the RFP on that, and I'll ask Mr. Chairman, with your permission, Lucky Welch, who heads up the Division of State Operated Health Facilities, to report on where that is right now.
Mr. Welch, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Secretary. I want to give you just a brief status report where we are on the forensic hospital consolidation RFP. As you're well aware, in last session, there was session law that directed the department and division to submit an issue, an RFP. And you can see also in the session law that the secretary could move forward that if he could determine that it would be result in a cost savings as well as to ensure the appropriate safety and quality of care for the patients that we serve. Pursuant to that, on July the 20th, we issued the RFP, and this was for a 90-bed forensic inpatient hospital facility and that it would be 30 beds of maximum, 30 beds of medium, and 30 beds of minimum, keeping in mind that there are different levels of care, maximum being the most most intense. The RFP detailed the clinical and programmatic and operational requirements for them to respond to. On August the 19th, we had mandatory visits from for all those that would like to issue an RFP. Those were conducted. And then again on August 22nd, on September 16th, we had a second site visit from two of the vendors. We received some questions, certainly from the vendors, on August 22nd, responded to them on September the 9th. And October 12th was our submission deadline. We received one proposal by that deadline. I appointed an evaluation committee, an eight-member evaluation committee, and they have met three different times, October 20th, 24th, and November the 4th, to consider the RFP and established procedures of the department as well as outlined in the RFP. On November the 4th, just this past Friday, we had a presentation from the vendor, and it was presented to us. And I would report to you that currently the RFP is under evaluation by the department and the division. And that's where we are today, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We'll hold questions until the end, unless there's a burning question. Thank you, sir. Secretary Counselor.
Okay, I think we are down to the Health and Wellness Trust Fund and a couple of the issues related to our division of public health, the transfer of environmental health, et cetera. So I'll ask Dr. Jeff Engel and from Division of Public Health and John Price to respond to the next series of questions.
Gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Price from the Office of Rural Health and Community Care. And Dr. Engel asked me to start off because a portion of this funding was transferred to our office to administer the programs, roughly $3.7 million of the total funding. The three programs that we're administering are the Medication Assistance Program. What we did with that program is continued to grant funds to the former Health and Wellness Trust sites. There are 53 sites around the state. All but one of the former grantees requested to continue, and that one was in Bladen County, and the community identified another grantee, and we continued funding in Bladen County, but with just a different grantee. This is not in your notes, but I found out this morning that those 53 sites in the 3 months since we began funding have provided services to over 19,000 patients and have pulled down over $21 million worth of pharmaceuticals from the pharmaceutical manufacturers' free drug programs. The Check Meds program, we have been able to continue the program as it was going using the same benefits manager as before when it was funded directly from the Health and Wellness Trust Fund Commission. The only slight change in this is we have identified $350,000 of that funding that came to us to match with some federal Medicaid match to help to implement the pilot Check Meds program that's directed in your budget in CCNC. And the third program is the Roanoke-Chowan Community Health Center Telehealth Initiative. Dr. Engel asked us to manage that contract for him. I'm happy to report that we now have a contract in place with them for $293,000, and we have begun receiving monthly invoices from that site as they begin to spend the money down. One of the questions had to do with ongoing support of any of these programs. The only one that we have any ongoing support for possibly for next year is the medications program, and that's because we received a grant from the KB Reynolds Charitable Trust for $550,000, of which we've used $200,000 to fill in some missing gaps in the funding this year, and they've indicated that we might be able to use that funding next year if we don't use it all this year. But it's, as you can see, that would only help to cover probably about 10 sites next year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Jeff Engel, the Division Director of Public Health, and continuing with the Health and Wellness Trust Fund transfer to the Division of Public Health. As Mr. Price indicated, there is the $22 million transfer of which he is continuing to run those programs that he just discussed. The remainder of the money is summarized in Attachment C that is at the end of your packet. And this totals approximately $18 million in programs. I'm not going to summarize the line item. That's certainly for your review. But just tell you that it was in two categories. The first category that summed up to approximately $14.5 million represents programs that were under existence under the pre-existing Health and Wellness Trust Fund that were transferred to the division and were continued. The second subtotal is approximately $3.5 million, and that represents unspent or unobligated Health and Wellness Trust Fund dollars that went into programming in the area of tobacco prevention and control. Another question from that is on page 11 was, in general, is there any plan to try and continue any of these activities through other funding sources listed under number four? Regarding these tobacco prevention control programs, we are ongoing and continuing to seek funding from our major federal funder, the CDC. But unfortunately, currently available funds through the Centers for Disease Control for tobacco prevention programs is less than 10% of the current amount that we get from the transfer from the Health and Wellness Trust Fund. Moving on then to page 11 are the environmental health transfer to the Division of Public Health. Generally going smoothly, the budget processes are being integrated. The conversion of the environmental health contracts and mini grants to the Department of Health and Human Services, our formats are in process. We're beginning to integrate certain programs into the division, notably the Environmental Health Childhood Lead Program is being more closely aligned with the division's health hazards unit to increase response capacity for locals and for case investigation. Human resource paperwork is in process, and early fixes to our environmental health websites have been completed to update contact information to the DHHS domain. Emails have been transferred and so on. Moving on to the area of Healthy Carolinians, the question was to report on the consolidation of Healthy Carolinians and health education. This is now on page 12 of your handout. The work of the Office of Healthy Carolinians and Health Education has been absorbed by our Chronic Disease and Injury Prevention section. They provide technical assistance needs for communities for the health-related needs and objectives that are being provided in an integrated fashion throughout the state and are meeting the integrated responsibility that was previously performed by the physicians that were eliminated on July 1, 2011. Under the Office of Healthy Carolinians that no longer exists, the certification and recertification process of Healthy Carolinian local partnerships will end this year. Partnerships will be encouraged to work with the division for technical assistance, their health data needs, quality improvement methods, and sustainability. Thank you.
Dr. Engel and Mr. Price, thank you very much for your comments, and we will hold off on our questions until we get to the end of our discussions. Secretary Counselor.
Mr. Chairman, the next question deals with block grants. As you know, about 70% of all the money we have in the department comes from federal funds and grants, and we have several major block grants. As they discuss the budget in Washington, they're beginning to modify some of these grants on which we based our budget. And so I'll ask Jim Slate from our Division of Budget Analysis to update you on where we are on some of the block grant funding.
Mr. Slate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first one that I wanted to discuss with you is the Preventive Health Block Grant. This block grant, as we've known it, has basically been eliminated. This is an impact of about $3.1 million to the state. However, the state is very fortunate in that through a federal level competitive grant process, it has been awarded a community transformation grant. It will not replace all of the things that the preventive health block grant was used for, but it will certainly minimize its impact. And I will share with you that through this competitive grant process, the state of North Carolina received the fourth largest award in the country, so we're real proud of that. The next item that I would like to discuss with you is the TANF block grant. In late September at the federal level, there was a temporary extension of TANF, and as a part of this temporary extension, they did not include funding for the supplemental portion of the TANF block grant, and this affects 17 states, and North Carolina was one of those states that it affected. So this translates into a loss to North Carolina of about $36.4 million in federal TANF dollars. The net impact of that in the current year's budget will be a $27.3 million reduction in TANF. We're in the process now of developing a revised plan that we'll share with you upon its completion. The only other comment that I would like to make about block grants is just a general comment, and that's, as of right now, we're not aware of any other immediate changes to block grants, but in all likelihood, with the actions by the Congressional Super Committee that are supposed to come out in late November, and then the vote in December by Congress on some of their recommendations, we fully anticipate that there'll be some other reductions to our block grants and other federal funding that the department receives as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Slate. Mr. Secretary?
Mr. Chairman, the next couple of questions relate to our low-income energy assistance program and our crisis intervention program. An update on that will come from Sherry Bradshaw, who's the director of our Division of Social Services.
Ms. Bradshaw, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Secretary. The low-income energy assistance block grant has gone through a couple of different changes, one that was initiated by our federal partners who in a review encouraged us to look at the automatic eligibles policy that has been in place in North Carolina for a number of years, and we have done that. In addition, it was the desire of this body that we move toward making vendor payments for the low-income energy assistance program, meaning that those payments would go directly to the companies and agencies that were actually serving the individuals. In addition to that, it was also decided that we needed to identify the targeted populations to receive the funding through the low-income energy assistance grant, and that targeted population is persons over the age of 60, and I think that's really important for us in that they are the disenfranchised or least served population when it comes to our crisis intervention program. So now we have an array of services that are available to serve all populations in need, particularly during our winter months. We estimate that with the $11.8 million available in the low-income energy assistance program that will serve nearly 30,000 households, providing them with relief of around $400 for those four coldest months of the year. In addition, changes have been made to the crisis intervention program, which now states that no payment shall exceed $600 for crisis intervention in one given year. The question that was asked of us is, what have we done to prepare for these changes? All the automation and reporting changes have been made. All 100 county departments of social services have been trained on the new policies. Those county departments of social services also assisted us in writing those new policies. On November the 2nd, we did a public release to all 100 county departments of social services and to all media outlets informing them of the changes in the program, and county departments departments of social services have begun their local campaigns. The Division of Aging and Adult Services has also provided information to the 100 county departments of social services on these targeted populations, who they are, and the demographic information so that they can begin working locally on the best ways to reach these individuals during the course of the next couple of months to make sure that they have adequate opportunity to apply for these funds. They are doing so by coordinating primarily with area aging agencies and senior centers. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bradshaw. Secretary Kanzler?
The next question relates to an update on NCFAS. And let me just say, Mr. Chairman, that of a lot of things that we're doing in Health and Human Services, this project is probably something that we are being watched nationally about what we're doing and how we're doing it. And this technology is a technology that's going to help the counties and do a lot of other things, but it really focuses on a larger effort to integrate our services and tear down the silos and be more effective in the way we do things. Just for a second, I'll just say that traditionally what the department's focused on is providing services, make sure that whoever needs services gets the services. But the whole effort of the integration of services is we've gone through the process of looking at everything we do, and we have like 265 different services and activities that we fund or do in some one way or the other. And when you just focus on providing services, you're making sure people get what they need, but not necessarily in a way that helps make them less dependent on those services. And so we've arranged our budget, we've arranged what we're doing, where we've categorized our services from very basic to very complex, so that we can look at all the people we serve and see where they are on that scale among five levels, with the focus of using our services as tools to try to bring them down the scale and make them more independent and less dependent upon the services we offer. We're working with the local county's departments of social services and changing the way we do business, so when you walk into a local department of social service, you don't go to this corner for Medicaid and this corner for child subsidy and this corner for food nutrition services, but hopefully get to a point to where we have an individual that can help with all of these, with the focus on what can we do to keep you from going up the intensity scale, but in fact work to try to bring you down the intensity scale. That's the only way long-term we're going to sustain the kind of things we do and help make people more independent. NCFAST is the technology tool that the counties will be able to use to help us get there. It's of great interest to me because when I sat in your chairs in 1998, I was sitting as a chair of this committee, and I helped appropriate the first money to start the planning for this. Consultants who looked at it and started doing some of the planning and design estimated that it would save the counties $300 million a year in duplicated work effort because of having all these little silos. I was asked last week to present at a national meeting of human services across the country. I was asked to present at that meeting because of the attention that we're getting for NCFAST and how we're trying to move to this more integrated model statewide. So I think this is something you can be proud of. I'm also proud of the fact that this project's basically on time and on budget, and that doesn't always happen, but it's got high support from the county commissioners, high support from the local DSS. It integrates. We've got a lot of great folks working on it. And I appreciate the support that you've given it. So at this point in time, I'll just say that's what it's about. It's going to give statewide case management so that people move from one county to the other. We know what's going on. It gives us more global information to help us make sure we're applying the right services to achieve the goals. It also has an eligibility engine that helps, based upon one entry of information, determine eligibility for different things. Medicaid being one of them, avoids that duplication at the local level. It will also have a child welfare piece, which we're trying to figure out if there's a way we can accelerate that, because we have a window here until about 2014 or 15 where we have enhanced federal money. So if I can find the state dollars to match it, we can actually get more federal money for some of this than what we were getting before to get this project done faster. We've got great cooperation among everyone. So I'll
when the time comes, answer any questions, but this is something that I'm personally very proud of, because I think it's going to help get us to where we need to go and provide a better level of support for the people we serve. The last series of, and by the way, on page 15 is a list of how much money to date since the initiation of the project has been spent in both federal and state dollars. Last thing that I think the last series of questions relate to other technology projects that we have going on, so I'm going to ask Karen Tomczak, who heads up our Division of Information Resource Management, to report on those questions.
Ms. Tomczak?
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to review what we're doing to work to finalize the Division of Information Resource Management continuation review and report that is due on December 1st. The report, when finalized, will cover software and operations and maintenance support for five contracts, as well as staff acquired through the ITS Supplemental Information Technology contract. In your packets, there are details concerning these contracts, specifically in relation to the business functions they support and some of the receipts that come in through those systems. I'm going to just highlight for you today the key points regarding those contracts. The first one is the Healthcare Enterprise Accounts Receivable and Tracking System, known as HARTS, which this contract covers the software maintenance and software support for the system installed in our 14 state-operated healthcare facilities. This system was implemented in 1999, and the key system functions include patient management and patient billing. The contract covers continual software upgrades for healthcare and billing, which allows us to comply with state and federal requirements. The second contract is a staffing contract for the DHHS Client Services Data Warehouse, known as CSDW, and we recently included with that contract the DMH Consumer Data Warehouse, known as CDW. These contracts cover the IT staffing support for ongoing and operations and maintenance for these warehouses. The contract provides support for meeting federal and state and specific grant requirements. The client services data warehouse is used by several divisions, somewhere in the neighborhood of seven, in DHHS spanning 30 business areas. To give you an idea about how large this warehouse is, today we house over 5 billion records in the warehouse. The client services data warehouse has been chosen as the data warehousing solution for NCFAST. It will supplement reports that are not part of the standard reporting solution, but for NCFAST, we will be able to provide a lot of ad hoc reporting using end-user tools to the counties and to the state with NCFAST. The third contract is the North Carolina Immunization Registry, known as NCIR, and it covers operations and maintenance support for the system. NCIR was implemented a few years ago and is the official source for immunization data and recommended vaccine information. The fourth contract is the Health Information System contract, known as HIS, and covers software maintenance and software support. It's similar to the contract that we have for HARTS because it provides ongoing software upgrades. As changes that have to be done, such as HIPAA 5010 and other upgrades, they're part of that ongoing contract. Key functions address capturing, monitoring, reporting, and billing services for DPH and associated entities. The fifth contract is the North Carolina Information and Referral Statewide Repository, known as NC CareLink, and it covers software maintenance and support. This system provides information referral data for NC residents, and this contract is currently under review, the maintenance portion of the contract, for potential changes prior to its next renewal term, which would be in December 2011. In addition to these five contracts, Durham is currently using the services of 13 supplemental information technology contractors for operational support. Seven of these are providing support for some of the large-scale DHHS systems, such as the food stamp information system, known as FSIS, and the automated collections and tracking system, known as ACTS. The remaining six contractors are providing infrastructure support to our divisions and offices, primarily in the area of desktop support and local area network support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tomczak. Secretary Cancellor.
Mr. Chairman, I think that concludes our report based upon the questions submitted, so we'll be happy to respond to any other questions or comments the members may have.
Yes, we thank you for the presentation. Representative Murray had a question, and then Representative McLawhorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question for Mr. Price about the CheckMeds NC Medication Assistance Program. Are your goals, those were pre-existing programs from the old Health and Wellness Trust Fund. I wanted to see kind of what your plans are for those two programs now that they're under your purview.
Thank you, Representative Murray. Since we only have funding through June 30th, the only thing we've been able to do is to continue the program as it was going, using the same pharmacy benefits manager and continuing the same services that were being continued. Beyond that would be dependent upon receiving additional funding.
Representative McLawhorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment. Secretary Cancellor and all of those of you who presented, this is, as a new member of this committee, this is extremely helpful to me. I really like the format that you have put this in. I have some questions, but I know individually now who to go to and ask those specific questions. And I especially want to thank you for spelling out what these abbreviations, these initials stand for. You know, I can halfway figure it out, or I'll ask my seatmates here, but this is very helpful, and thank you for doing it this way.
Further questions from members of the committee? For you, you've got the experts here, so now is the time to ask you questions. Senator Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions. One is back on page 6, your response to legislative question 10. You refer to the work of a physician advisory group. Is there a way that, or can you tell me the best way to monitor the progress of that group?
The physician advisory group is physicians who, under statute, we have to consult with. Interestingly enough, I couldn't tell you who's in the group, and it was designed kind of that way to avoid a lobbying effort as they were considering. Their job is to look at the clinical aspects of what's going on, and they report. We make presentations to them what's happening. They discuss it, and they make recommendations back. They do not make decisions, but they do make recommendations, and our statutory responsibility is to go to them to consult and get their input. I can certainly get folks from the Division of Medical Assistance to provide you with some additional information about that, but that is a statutorily set thing that basically is made up, to my knowledge, totally of physicians.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I have one more question, if I may. On page 16, you're talking about the health information system that's talking how you keep track of you have a master person index. Is that system going to allow a cross-referencing of those individuals to other data sets in the state? For example, if I wanted to compare how the people on food stamps are accessing health care or any other data set, you know, for research purposes, is this system going to allow that kind of a cross-referencing?
There are currently a number of interfaces, but predominantly in the Division of Public Health area between HIS. For example, we're looking at other things like NCIR, so we have current interfaces. However, over the last several months, we have been implementing in our client services data warehouse, pulling in HIS data into that environment, which is primarily today the most of the data there within that environment is DSS data. So we have the ability to be able to take data from those two types of sources and match that data and provide reporting.
Let me just add that, you know, one of the challenges we have as an agency, and you kind of hit on the nail there, is the fact that as programs and activities have been developed over the years, so has
software applications to serve that particular program. So the end, I know we used to have over 200, I think, different systems in the agency, none of which talked to each other. One of the big issues that we have, and NCFAST is a big part of this, is how do we integrate that data so that we do have a more global look at the individual we serve rather than just the bucket that we may be talking about at the time. It's not been unusual to have a question that we need answered, and you go and you get information out of a system, and it gives you an answer, and then you realize, well, wait a minute, they're doing something here, and they're doing something here, so you pull information out of those other systems, and then you have to manually decide how do you mix it. So a big focus we've had in our technology is as we build the new MMIS for Medicaid and other payments, as we develop this NCFAST, which provides more of a global case management, and the other things we're doing is to make sure that we're pulling in information from multiple places as opposed to just building a system to do one thing and it doesn't talk to anybody else.
Further questions from members of the committee?
Yes.
Representative Hurley.
That's all right.
give me some slack.
Yes, I sure will. I just wanted to ask about the tobacco cessation programs. Do we ever get any money from the Golden Leaf Foundation?
Thank you, Representative Hurley. No.
Why not?
The Golden Leaf, as I understand it, is money for economic development and not for public health.
Just
you have another
comment.
Question? Go ahead. Representative Hurley.
Thank you. It should be for tobacco stuff, too. Thank you.
Further questions from members of the committee? Chairman Dollar has a question.
Thank you. I think this is right in response to Representative Hurley's question. That money does all come from the Master Settlement Agreement. So it's Health and Wellness Trust Fund, or what it was. It was a piece of that along with the Tobacco Trust Fund. And there was one other fund, name's escaping me right now. But let me ask you a couple of questions. One for Mr. Welsh. I appreciate the department has moved forward in fully exploring the potential for consolidating these forensic services. And I guess my question is, did y'all have or do you have at this point in time an estimate, assuming things work out with the vendor that that has moved forward in the process and that you're in the final phases of your evaluation as to their proposal. But can you give us at least a preliminary estimate of how much we could potentially save if that proposal is sufficient and we move forward with it from consolidating those services?
Representative Dollar, we have been in that thorough evaluation and have recently had discussions with the Secretary of where we are in that, so he may want to comment where we are today.
That's called shifting. They have done some analysis, and the analysis so far does not indicate a significant amount of savings. I had some questions when they had that discussion with me, and so before I think we can really comment on that, I've got to get some additional questions answered, which is the reason we aren't ready to report one way or the other today. But as soon as we have a little better idea about a few things, then we'll certainly be in touch.
Okay. And I think that, just to sort of finish loop for a second, I think part of what our thinking was on that as well was just in being able to free up needed bed space at Central Regional Hospital, and you would agree that that would be a good goal to free up more beds at Central, right?
That certainly would be a benefit of the process, and we're also looking at some other opportunities to potentially give us more flexibility on bed space in our hospitals.
Right. Let me, on another quick area, we discussed signing up age blind and disabled for CCNC. We discussed that. Mr. Watson discussed that at the governmental GovOps. Let me just ask the question this way. Are we on track? I mean, obviously we were off track, but at this point in time, are we on track to get that most expensive and most beneficial budget-wise, I suppose, as well as care management-wise, population signed up in the numbers that we were looking to get them signed up in CCNC? And what is your estimate of when we will complete that?
I don't know exactly when we'll complete it, but we are certainly on line. I've had a conversation about an all-hands-on-deck kind of approach online to increase our efforts and try to better coordinate the efforts of enrolling folks. I don't have a report back on what how they think that's going to change the timing, but again, I know that the issues that we had, I hope we have corrected, and I'll be monitoring that.
Okay. Another question. It was my understanding that, and maybe I've got this wrong, but it was my understanding that the Milliman Group had been doing a study or had done a study or completed a study with respect to savings with CCNC and some of the other activities. Is that study ready to be presented, or has it been presented, or can you give us an update on that?
I believe that study will indicate a substantial savings in 2010 by CCNC's efforts, and if I'm not mistaken, I think Dr. Dobson will report on that in his presentation this afternoon.
Okay. And then one other question that actually came to me from a constituent, and it kind of made me curious, but the constituent was thinking back years past that in many instances the hospitals we're talking about facilities during the budget year would only be funded at 100%, but maybe be funded at 85 or 90% during the year in order to have funds at the end of the year in case those funds were needed to fill gaps or to go other places. If you could comment maybe just generally about how, for example, facilities are funded during the year. Do we try to hold back at least some percentage, or are facilities, given the need that's out there, funded much closer to 100%? Of course, it's never 100%. Sometimes it's over 100%.
Well, at least during my tenure as secretary, I don't know that we've withheld well. I mean, what we try to do is pay the bills, and quite honestly, you know, we put a lot of emphasis on finding ways to improve the financial operations of the facilities with some of the things we're doing. That's why we're trying to reduce agency personnel and overtime and hire more people that will cost us less. That's why we're putting in the financial system, doing all these sorts of things. The fact of the matter is. You know, we were $20-some million in total cost over budget, and we were having to pull those dollars from elsewhere in the department to pay the bills. We were not paying and still do not always pay bills on time, and the result is we lose potential discounts on purchases. Sometimes we pay penalties for late payment. I've had a situation where the Progress Energy threatened to cut off the power. And so trying to work through the cash shortages and deal with that is something that I'm trying to reduce the need for additional appropriations, but sooner or later we've got to get them where they're funded properly and make sure that we can meet all the needs, because it's actually costing us money to be late on paying the bills. So I don't think we have an opportunity to withhold funds. We're actually finding funds elsewhere in order to try to keep the bills paid as best we can.
Well, just following up on that, so at some point in time we probably need to do some more work in terms of, and I know this is a long-term issue, it's been out there for quite a while, but getting alignment between, for example, the positions that we have and having to use a lot of those lapped salaries to serve contracts because we can't get positions filled, and I think there's an interest in trying to work with the department to address that issue.
And we are working with state budget right now on processes for which we can do that better. And our goal is, again, we think we can save a couple $1 million a year if we can make some changes in the way that we're hiring and staffing. Because if you got to run a facility, you either got to have staff there or you got to close beds. And our choice in the past has been agency personnel and a lot of overtime, and we're trying to correct that, and hopefully we will be able to do that.
Thank you.
Senator Blake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Secretary, you mentioned the $10 million that you were needing to pay in the next quarter, a payback. Is that payback on the $300 million? And one other question, do we now have a fixed amount that we are obligated to pay back?
We had a fixed amount. It was $320 or $30 million. And we negotiated with the federal government to pay that back in quarterly installments. And we should have it totally repaid with two additional installments in the next fiscal year. So we're within four installments, I think, of having it repaid.
Further questions from the committee? We're going to have to go out and forage for food in just a few minutes. I think everything, all the eating establishments have closed, but the chair did err in not bringing to your attention the minutes for adoption. The minutes have been distributed. I hope by now you've had a chance to read them. Senator Hartzell has made a motion that the minutes be adopted as reported. Is there a second? We heard a second. Those in favor say aye. All opposed, no. The minutes are adopted. Thank you very much, Secretary, you and your staff, for your presentation. If the grad students from the university are still here, I think they've all left to go back and change their major. But thank you very much for being here and persevering with us today. Those members, if you have not yet submitted your reimbursement form, please do so. We come back in session again at 2 p.m. today. Thank you.